Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, and call unless we don't call in unless we ask for it. We have with us this afternoon David Wade, who's written a book called Infamy. It's the story of the attack at Pearl Harbor, and of course this is Pearl Harbor today. This is exactly 64 years ago when Pearl Harbor was attacked. And I was a boy of about 12 years old at that time. I can remember that day. It will live in my life forever. Now, you know, it was certainly Lord Byron who said, 'Tis strange but true, for truth is always strange, stranger than fiction. And Daniel Webster thundered, there is nothing so powerful as truth, and often nothing so strange. And that's really true. It's very difficult for the American people to believe that an American president would know the attack was coming on Pearl Harbor and leave the soldiers and the airmen there to die. And yet, of course, history records this is really very true. I went to the Sterling Library back at Yale University in 1980. I actually copied the pages from Secretary of War Stimson's diary. Of course, he was Skull and Bones. He was CFR. He was part of this whole ruling hierarchy. But in that diary, and we send you free of charge the pages from that if you'd like, he says, you know, we went on the 25th of November of 1941 to the White House, and there was Secretary of the Navy Frank Knox, and there was George Catlett Marshall, and there was Admiral Short, who was the naval commander, and the president, just five of us. And the president said, well, we can anticipate the Japanese will attack probably this coming weekend, because they usually attack, you know, with a surprise attack. And the only question is how we were going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot. So, of course, they wanted to get into the war. They knew the American people did not want to go to war because they were disillusioned after the First World War when they found out they'd been lied to. And so 90% of the American people did not want to go to war on December 6, 1941. But 90% or more wanted to go to war on December 8th. We were manipulated by the events that took place on December 7th, and that is why David Wade's book, Infamy, is so important. David, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, as always.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how it was that you came to write your book?
Well, I always had an interest in American history, and it grew out of my interest in the Second World War. And that interest in the Second World War was implanted in me, I think, because I grew up in a small community back in the 1950s, and the fathers of nearly all the children I went to school with were World War II veterans. They were always talking about the war, and it was, to me, actually one of the most real events in my world, although I was born some years after the war had actually ended. And one of the things they always talked about was Pearl Harbor. And I noticed even back then, among veterans who had patriotically served their country, that Pearl Harbor was always mentioned with a certain doubt and suspicion. It was as though they had detected that there was something fishy, after all, about how we got into the war in the first place.
And 400,000 Americans died.
400,000 Americans died, yes.
And many of them, of course, carried the pain of their wounds to their death.
So, hundreds of thousands of others were wounded.
We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest this afternoon is David Wade. And David's written a wonderful book called Infamy. It's the story of Pearl Harbor. And so I've asked David to be with us today because it was 64 years ago today when the attack came on Pearl Harbor, early in the morning, just as the sun was coming up. Why, of course, they struck. But the question is, did the people in Washington, D.C. know the attack was coming and intentionally not warn the American commanders so they could be on the alert, so they could have the planes in the air, so they could put their ships to sea? Or did they leave the people there to die because we needed an excuse to go to war? And with that as the background, David Wade has written a fascinating book called Infamy. David, you pick up this story.
Infamy Revisited is the title.
Infamy Revisited.
Yes, sir. Well, yes, the answer to the question, it now seems to me quite clearly that the President of the United States himself, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and a small handful of his closest advisors knew not only that the Japanese were going to attack, but also knew that they were going to attack Pearl Harbor, and knew that the attack would be coming over the weekend of the 7th of December.
And, of course, they specifically withheld that information from the commanders at Pearl Harbor. That's what's so unconscionable about
that. Oh, yes, there is a clear pattern there. It's Admiral Kimmel, who was in command of our fleet at Pearl Harbor, and General Short, who commanded the land forces in Hawaii, were kept in the dark. And there's a pattern there that indicates that this was deliberate.
And, of course, they had investigation after investigation, which was, of course, authorized by the president, and he put people onto the commissions who would be sure not to get the truth to the American people. And do you know, if you're out across America, that to this very day, 64 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, much of the information surrounding what happened that day is still classified, because the last thing they want is for the American people to know that a president of the United States would have left those men there to die. He would have betrayed his men, and if he would do it, could it ever happen again?
Well, yes, that's a very good question. If you look at the whole history of our country, time and again, you find presidents of the United States who seem to scheme to get us into war. The example of Pearl Harbor is a notorious example, but it's only one of many that could be cited.
And, of course, it was Woodrow Wilson who promised that he would never send our boys to war, and yet 2 months after he was reelected, he asked for it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Wade. His book is Infamy Revisited, and we were just simply mentioning that Woodrow Wilson had run in for re-election in 1916.
He kept us out of war.
He kept us out of war.
Was the slogan in 1916. Yeah.
And, of course, he was then inaugurated in January, February, and within 2 months in April, while he was asking for a declaration of war so we could go to war. And he'd always planned on going to war because he wanted to change the world. War is how you change the world, and America was to lead this new world. And, of course, the whole purpose of the First World War was to bring about the League of Nations. And then, of course, we know what happened with Vietnam. The Gulf of Tonkin incident was totally contrived, but Vietnam was a wonderful diversion as America was changed at home. And, of course, this was to change America, just as Iraq today is a wonderful diversion. And as our boys go overseas to fight for freedom, we are losing our freedom here at home. So let's get into the background of Pearl Harbor and what you've learned.
Well, what I have learned is that in spite of 9 separate investigations into Pearl Harbor, the government of the United States successfully stonewalled the public from knowing vital information about Pearl Harbor. It was only with the passing of the Freedom of Information Act and the work of a number of very diligent historians, namely John Tolan and Robert Stinnett, both of whom wrote books on Pearl Harbor using the Freedom of Information Act, that new information was turned up that was not presented at any of those previous investigations. The new information tells us that the Japanese Strike Force, Kido Butai, as it crossed the North Pacific, did indeed violate radio silence.
And of course, we're told the reason we had no idea where this Japanese fleet was, because there was absolute radio silence, and that really wasn't true, was it, David?
It wasn't true at all. As a matter of fact, there were hundreds of radio messages that were sent, not only between the ships themselves, but by various admirals in home ports and in other locations all across the Pacific, between and among the Japanese strike force. And some of these messages were actually intercepted by us before the Japanese fleet struck Pearl Harbor. We were not able to decode them, but we knew that the messages were being sent in Japanese code. Therefore, we knew they were coming from Japanese ships. And we could identify the location of these ships on the high seas, and we could also plot their progress as they closed in on Pearl Harbor. You have a large Japanese fleet. It's headed across the North Pacific. It's aimed at Pearl Harbor. What do you think is going to happen? Why are there six aircraft carriers out there and all those cruisers, battleships, and submarines? What's going on? It wouldn't take much in the way of rocket science to conclude the Japanese are going to attack Pearl Harbor.
Well, I think what was interesting was that the Laureline, and you mentioned that in your book, the Laureline was a passenger liner that flied back and forth between the coast of California and the Hawaii
Islands. It was on its way to Hawaii at the time, and there was a guy by the name of Leslie Grogan who was the assistant telegrapher. And he was the first one to receive Japanese radio traffic. And he started getting a cloud of messages, which he knew were in Japanese code, and he recorded this in his log. As soon as his ship arrived in Hawaii, which was, I believe, the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, he was greeted by naval intelligence officers who confiscated that log. And it has never been seen by mortal man since.
And I think it's so similar to what happened after the bombing of the Murrah Building in 1995. Immediately, the FBI descended and removed all the videotapes that would have shown who was in the Ryder truck with Tim McVeigh. And what happened on September 11th? The FBI immediately removed all of the tapes from the video cameras focused on the Pentagon that would have told us what really happened that morning. And those tapes have never been seen since then. So, but the incredible thing is, most Americans don't understand that most of the information about Pearl Harbor is still considered top secret or classified, because they cannot let Emperor Hirohito know what we knew before the attack. Either that, or they're afraid the American people will realize that a president would kill 3,000 American boys or 2,400 American boys, and yet he is glorified in our textbooks today, that wonderful FDR, whereas, of course, he should be exposed for the hypocrite he was.
Well, yes, and right after Pearl Harbor was bombed, an order came down from the head of Naval Intelligence to everyone who was at Naval Intelligence Headquarters, ONI on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C., to destroy anything in writing that had anything whatsoever to do with the Pearl Harbor attack. That was a direct order.
That must be before they had the shredders or they could destroy the evidence. Now, of course, what was the story about this this Dutch diplomat? Because John Toland checked that story out, and I know...
Yeah, Johannes Roneft. Johannes Roneft, and as a matter of fact, I think he was still alive even when Stinnett wrote his book, because I recall that he was interviewed one final time when the man was a very advanced age and on his deathbed, and he once again confirmed the story. He was actually at the Office of Naval Intelligence Headquarters in Washington, D.C., a couple of days before Pearl Harbor was bombed, and he wandered down a corridor, and he was where he was not supposed to be. And he passed an open door, and he saw officers sitting around a baize table and another officer pointing to a large map with a pointer, and the other officer said, "This is the Japanese fleet. It's approaching Pearl Harbor." That's one of many anecdotes that have been related about people who actually got wind of the attack.
But of course, he reported that information to his own government. And when John Tolan, many years later, would actually research the story, he actually went to Holland or sent people to Holland to check out to make sure it was true. And when Robert Stinnett, of course, did his book, Day of Deceit, he did exactly the same thing. And we have interviews with both Stinnett and John Tolan, where they tell the story of checking the story out, and the day before the attack, they knew exactly where the Japanese fleet was, but the only people who didn't know were the commanders at Pearl Harbor.
Well, we had broken the Japanese diplomatic code, and we had also decoded at least part of their naval code, JN-25, the so-called five-number code. And we had deciphered a message that was sent out called East Wind Rain, Higashi no Kazeyami in Japanese, which means East Wind Rain. We knew what that message meant. It meant war with the United States. And it was a message that was sent out in diplomatic code to all the Japanese embassies all over the world. That message, I'm sure, was intercepted. There were numerous naval officers who came forward and said that they had seen the message, among them Lawrence Safford, who actually had an opportunity to testify. But his testimony was denied. As a matter of fact, he ended up being dismissed from the Navy and remanded for psychiatric treatment by the U.S. Navy. He stuck to his guns and said he saw the message.
And of course, the thing is, they cannot let the American people know that, because think of the implications. The whole Second World War was contrived. And of course, if you get the material we have on it, you'll find out how it was the American corporations and banks and industries that had actually funded Adolf Hitler, who built his war machine. Anybody would like to see the letter that Ambassador Dodd, I found this back at Yale University, the letter Ambassador Dodd, the American ambassador to Germany, sent to Colonel House in 1936 saying, why are American corporations building up the war-making material of the Germans? Nobody wants a war over here, and yet American corporations are building up the war-making potential. There's 100 American corporations, and they can't make any money because the exchange restrictions, they can't get any money out of the country, and yet they're building up the war-making capacity. Well, of course, when you understand that the war was simply another of the wars that had been fought to bring about the New World Order, it all makes sense. Otherwise, none of this makes sense. Why would you spend a lot of your own money to build war materials for Adolf Hitler when you couldn't make a profit on it unless there was another agenda? So, and then, of course, many people justified what Adolf FDR did, what FDR did, saying, well, he had to do that. It was a justifiable thing. You know, we had to sacrifice those boys because the American people didn't want to go to war, and we had to get into the war because we had to stop Adolf Hitler. So didn't you run into that sort of rationale among many people?
You, as a matter of fact, it sort of surprised me when I started doing interviews about this book, how many people conceded that, yes, Franklin Roosevelt may very well have known about the attack and let it go forward because he needed the attack, because we had to get into the war, because we were the only people who could save Europe from Hitler. And the only answer I can give to that, I suppose, is what St. Paul said, do not follow a multitude to do evil. Do not do evil that good may come of it.
And of course, when you find out that many of our corporations were dealing with Adolf Hitler, not only before the war, but during the war, and that's covered in a book called Trading with the Enemy, and of course, the Japanese had tried to surrender for 6 months, and we wouldn't let them, and the invasion of both Okinawa and Iwo Jima, and the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, totally unnecessary. And if you'd like that documented, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the Chicago Tribune article. We'll send it to you. We got it from the Chicago Tribune. And that's included in our Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus. But you must understand, the Japanese have been trying to surrender, and we weren't going to let them surrender because we wanted as much horror and carnage as you possibly could. Because, of course, out of that would come the demand for the United Nations, the New World Order, the New World Religion. We'll be back in just a moment with David Wade as we discuss infamy revisited here at Radio Liberty.
This is a fascinating four tape set, Genocide, and one of the tapes is an interview with a Dr. Dinigan, who heard back in 1969 actually a talk given by Dr. Day, who would later become the president of Planned Parenthood. And Dr. Day laid out the whole plan for America, the fact there are too many people, the fact that we're going to have to create new diseases, the fact that we're going to have to conceal some of the very obvious treatments for cancer, because people are going to have to die of something. They might as well die of cancer. An incredible interview, and a series of other interviews that will go into the background of what is happening in America, why new diseases are cropping up all the time. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of our four-tape set, Genocide. It's vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. America, our values, our future are under attack today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. A secret of healthy aging was recently found among people who have lived unusually long, healthy lives. The longest-lived woman, Jean Calment of France, who lived 122 years, and man, Antonio Todd of the Italian Isle of Sardinia, who lived 115 years, as well as the Queen Mother of England, who lived 100 years, outliving one of her daughters by 3 decades, was their daily consumption of red wine. But health authorities have been reticent to recommend an alcoholic beverage to the public at large until now. Longevinex is the world's first stabilized French red wine extract in a pill, without the calories and without the alcohol or sulfite preservatives. One Longevinex capsule provides the red wine molecules found in 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done: get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap, it's a miracle.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, David's book, Infamy Revisited, is the story of Pearl Harbor. It's the story that I think documents, beyond any question of doubt, that the administration, President Roosevelt and a few people surrounding him, knew the attack was coming and intentionally withheld that information from the commanders at Pearl Harbor, because we needed an incident to get into war, just as, of course, as FDR, pardon me, as Lyndon Johnson, needed an incident to get us into Vietnam. That was the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and now all the studies show it never took place. It was all a lie, and 58,000 American boys died in Vietnam. in a war we never tried to win and we never should have gone into. So pick up the story there, David. What about that morning? Certainly General George Catlett Marshall knew the attack was coming. He'd been at that meeting I described earlier, Secretary of War Stimson had described. They knew the war was coming. They knew it was going to come.
Yes, definitely knew it. As a matter of fact, you know, it's an interesting thing that just a couple of days before Pearl Harbor, George C. Marshall had a press conference, and attending that press conference were a select small number of highly trusted members of the press. And at that press conference, Marshall announced that America would be at war with Japan within the next few days. He also told them, please don't tell anybody about this. Very strange.
Well, you see, they can't let the American people realize that they were looking for an incident, because on December 6th, 90% of the people didn't want to go to war. On December 8th, 90% of the people wanted to go to war. So it was this fury, this anger that was created by Pearl Harbor that precipitated this desire to enter into a totally futile war, because it accomplished nothing. It turned Eastern Europe over to the communists. It led to the fall of China, and it went communist. Adolf Hitler could have been stopped at any time if we'd just stopped financing him, but we weren't going to do that.
There is definitely a theory which has been entertained by many historians that if, in fact, we had not gotten involved in the war, Hitler and Stalin would have fought each other to a bloody stalemate. And the German people, the German general staff, was already plotting to overthrow Hitler, and they would have gone ahead and done it, and they would have had the support of the German people. Hitler would have been eliminated, and the war between Russia and Germany would have ended in some sort of compromise peace.
All right, now, what about General George Catlett Marshall that morning?
Well, that morning, George Catlett Marshall went for his usual horseback ride and was nowhere to be found, which was very strange behavior because, as I said, he knew that war was imminent within a matter of days, if not hours. He himself had told the select members of the press that just the day or so before that. And his intelligence officer, Rufus Bratton, was looking for him and couldn't find him. He finally did track him down. Marshall came back to his office, I think it was at Fort Myer, Bratton says, look, we have to warn Pearl Harbor that there is an attack that could happen at any moment now. And Marshall hemmed and hawed and hesitated. He could have picked up the scrambler phone and called Admiral Kimmel or General Short immediately. He didn't do so. He said, well, I don't want to do this because I'm not sure this phone is secure. This was the same system that Franklin D. Roosevelt used to communicate on a regular basis with Winston Churchill. And yet, all of a sudden, Marshall had scruples about using it because he wasn't sure it was secure. Well, then they were going to send a wire by way of the regular U.S. Army, the regular U.S. Army radiogram. He said that the system was down. So he finally resorted to writing out in longhand a message to be sent by way of Western Union telegram. And that Western Union telegram warning of the attack of Pearl Harbor arrived by a Western Union boy on a bicycle just as the attack was ending. And the strange thing is that we know that that system, the radiogram system, was not down, because there were numerous other people that same morning who had received warnings, including General MacArthur in the Philippines, using the same system. Once again, very strange behavior. And likewise, the commander of the U.S. Navy, Admiral Harold G. Stark, was absent the night before. They were looking for him because they had just received the last of a 14-point message that the Japanese in Tokyo were sending to Ambassadors Nomura and Caruso in Washington, D.C. And the 14th part of the message made it absolutely clear that this means war. And they couldn't find Admiral Stark. In fact, we couldn't find anybody.
Hold that thought right there.
Yeah.
The Anglo-American establishment gives you the documentation for Professor Quigley's allegation that there was a secret society created in England that ultimately came to dominate England and ultimately came to dominate the United States of America. The Anglo-American establishment will give you the books that you can read, written by men who were actually involved in the original secret society. Professor Quigley opens his book saying that most people have heard of the Rhodes Scholarships, and a few people have actually heard that Cecil Rhodes wrote a confession of faith, which was attached to his first five wills, talking about the formation of a secret society. But what almost no one in America realizes today is that that secret society was actually formed and still exists to this very day. The Anglo-American Establishment by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is one of the most important books you'll ever read, and available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Are we coming through?
Yes.
Sophisticated
okay,
investors
fine,
are buying gold and silver today because the dollar has lost almost 50% of its value in relationship to the euro, and the price of gold and silver has increased almost 40%. If you're interested in learning more about precious metal investing, why don't you call Bo at 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177, or visit him at Elliott's Stamp and Coin Shop in downtown Santa Cruz at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building, which is located between Trader Joe's and the Signature Twin Movie Theater. Bo's telephone number is 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177. And he's located at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building. And if you mention you heard about Elliott Stamp and Coin Shop on Radio Liberty, why, you'll get a 15% discount on some non-investment items.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is David Wade. His book, Infamy Revisited, we do carry the book. We think it's an important book. It's easy reading, and of course, what David has done is simply review all of the other books that were written, those written by Admiral Kimmel, those written by Robert Stinnett, Day of Deceit, and John Tolan, Infamy. And certainly, you've done a great job, I think, of drawing all the information together there, David.
Well, yes. As the old saying goes, I stand upon the backs of giants. There was so much research that was done by a number of historians that have been skeptical from the very beginning. George Morgenstern, who wrote a book about Pearl Harbor, commissioned by Colonel McCormick, the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, and the professor of history, Harry Elmer Barnes, who wrote a book called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, about Pearl Harbor, and Professor Charles Callan Tanzel from Georgetown University, who wrote a book called Pearl Harbor: Back Door to War. These are books that were all written back in the 40s and the early 50s.
And I've read all of them, and of course, Harry Elmer Barnes goes into the background, and we have his book, Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, where he talks about how they've rewritten the history of the Second World War, and he talks about the Rockefeller Foundation and the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, he actually quotes from an article by Charles Austin Beard, who is a well-known historian, talking about the Council on Foreign Relations and the Rockefeller Foundation and how they were going to be sure that the truth never came out about what had happened during the Second World War as it had come out after the First World War, and the people realized the First World War had been totally contrived and totally unnecessary, and we never should have entered. They couldn't let the American people know that about the Second World War, because maybe we wouldn't have gone into Korea, and then we wouldn't have gone into Vietnam, and then we wouldn't have gone into Iraq.
Well, we certainly wouldn't know about Pearl Harbor. What we do know now, if it weren't for the Freedom of Information Act, and I'd like to research the history of that legislation, how it ever got passed, and how it ever survived a presidential veto. But thank God that there is a Freedom of Information Act, because it was in using it that Robert Stinnett was able to turn up what I think is really the smoking gun.
Why don't you tell our listeners about the smoking gun?
Well, the smoking gun is the interception of Japanese radio transmissions from the Japanese fleet in the North Pacific, headed toward no other destination than Pearl Harbor. This was flowing into the 12th Naval District Intelligence at San Francisco. He may still be alive. I don't know. He was at the time that Stinnett wrote the book, published it in 1999. There was a young intelligence officer there by the name of Robert Ogg, who was actually present and who swore that he saw this naval intelligence, Japanese messages, which could only come from a Japanese strike force headed towards Pearl Harbor. The commander of intelligence at the 12th Naval District was Commander Richard T. McCullough. The information would have gone directly to the commander. As it happened, Richard T. McCullough was an old friend of Franklin D. Roosevelt. They had known each other for years. Roosevelt had been Assistant Secretary of the Navy during the First World War and had maintained many relationships with naval officers in the years between. McCullough had the private number of the White House and could get in direct contact with Roosevelt. Putting all of that together, it seems inconceivable that Richard T. McCullough would not have immediately called Franklin D. Roosevelt as soon as this information was made available to him and told him, yes, the Japanese fleet is headed towards Pearl Harbor. And this was 2 days before the attack.
I think there was another thing, and it came from somebody else named McCullough, as I remember.
McCullum, yes. McCullum. It's easy to get them confused. There was also a young naval officer by the name of Arthur H. McCullum, who, as it happens, once again, was personally acquainted with Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was an intelligence officer. He wrote what's called the famous or infamous McCullum Memo now. And that was on the 7th of October, 1940. Interestingly enough, when Franklin D. Roosevelt was in a political campaign running for a third term and pledging that American boys would never fight
in foreign wars. They'd never fight. I hate war. That's Eleanor
right.
hates war. Even
Eleanor
my little dog, Fala hates
war. Your boys will not be sent to fight in a foreign war.
And he was lying?
Solemn pledge he gave. Right around that time that he gave that pledge, Arthur McCullum wrote this memo, which was an 8-point memo, telling the President of the United States just exactly what it is America should do in order to get into a war with Japan. And sooner or later, in one way or another, every single one of those 8 points was complied with.
And of course, he called for an oil embargo.
An embargo of all Japanese strategic goods and freezing Japanese assets in America. We did that. A violation of Japanese territorial waters. The establishment of a relationship with Great Britain over the harbor of Singapore and Malaya, and moving the American fleet from its safe bases in California, San Pedro, to the Hawaiian Islands.
And of course,
they would be in range of a Japanese attack.
And of course, the American Navy didn't want it to, and there was Admiral Richardson who was in charge
That's
of the Pacific
right.
Fleet.
Admiral Richardson had a big dust-up with Franklin Roosevelt, and Roosevelt fired him. Richardson did not want the fleet moved to Hawaii. He thought it would be vulnerable there, and he thought it could not be adequately supplied and maintained. And Roosevelt canned him and replaced him with Kimmel.
And of course, but this is what McCollum had actually suggested, putting it at Pearl Harbor, because it would be almost like a magnet to drive the Japanese.
It would be like a provocation, And figure one way or the other, if all of these 8 points are complied with, we will have a war with Japan. And if you read the preface of this memo, he states explicitly, very clearly, America has to get into war with Japan. It's the best thing that we can do, short of what we are already now doing, to aid Great Britain, because the Japanese are sooner or later going to attack British possessions in the Pacific.
And of course, what's really so incredible is we had been doing everything prior to that to build up the Japanese military, just as we are doing everything we can today to build up the Chinese military in preparation for the coming war. We build it up for the coming war with Japan, and we are building China today up, financing them, providing the military and scientific technology for World War III.
And yeah, well, the history of Roosevelt's diplomacy with Japan just previous to the war is enigmatic and very strange, because he had one opportunity after the other to act as a negotiator to end the war
with China,
With China, and he did not take the initiative. It was almost as though he wasn't interested in that whole thing. It was only when the war broke out in Europe in 1939 that all of a sudden he became very concerned about Japanese aggression in Asia. And even after that period, he had opportunities where the Japanese shown their willingness to negotiate. But Roosevelt did not take the initiative again. Instead, through his Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, we imposed a list of non-negotiable demands upon the Japanese that they break off their tripartite pact with Germany and Italy, that they immediately withdraw all of their forces from China, including Manchuria, which they had occupied back in 1931. I mean, impossible demands that they could not have complied with. We deliberately failed to meet them halfway, and it was as a result of that, as a matter of fact, that the Konoye ministry fell from power, because he could not negotiate an arrangement with Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt deliberately refused to meet the Japanese Emperor Hirohito to negotiate such an arrangement. Konoye lost face. He fell from power, and it was then and only then that the war party under Tojo came to power.
And, of course, the thing is, this was all manipulated, and the Japanese weren't smart enough to realize they were being manipulated into war.
It was there was a very clear pattern, quite aside from what pre-knowledge Roosevelt might have had of Pearl Harbor. There was a very clear pattern that he was doing everything in his power to provoke Japan, starting from the outbreak of the war in Europe in 1939. And as a matter of fact, as former President Herbert Hoover once said, if you keep on sticking and up pins in a snake, sooner or later it will bite you.
And of course, we can see what's going on in the world today, whilst we are doing everything we can to inflame the anger and the hatred of the Muslim world and much of the rest of the world. Why would you do something like that unintentionally?
That's another topic, but I have my own opinion on that. I think we have assumed a new foreign policy, a very aggressive foreign policy that's based upon two things. First, control of oil as a strategic asset, and second, the security interests of Israel, rather than the legitimate national self-interests of the United States, because I believe there's a coterie that has been operating in the Bush administration that convinced the president to go to war, and we did so on the flimsiest grounds, as we now know.
Well, I think it's so important we understand the past, because if we don't understand what happened at Pearl Harbor, and that the leaders lied, and much of the media lied to the American people, and the people in the military who tried to tell the truth about what was known ahead of time, and the fact that this was a setup, they, of course, lost their professional jobs just as recently when, of course, some of the military officers wanted to try to let the American people know that we knew all about Muhammad Atta before, a year before the 9/11 attack. They have been silenced, ordered not to testify, and their military careers have ended. So, I mean, it's like deja vu all over again. Well, now as you go
deja
back...
Deja vu all over again, yes. As
you go back and you look at Pearl Harbor, why don't you sort of describe, we started to tell about what happened on the morning of September 11th. Here we have George Catlett Marshall. He knows the attack is coming. And, of course, now the wind message is in. The diplomatic code has been broken. We know that the Japanese ambassador is going to come to the White House, and I think it was going to be at noon or 1 o'clock, which would be 7 o'clock in the morning. They knew that's when the attack was coming. General George Catlett Marshall's chief aide comes to the general and says, we've got to notify the commanders at Pearl Harbor. The attack is coming, and what does General Marshall do?
Well, yes, General Marshall, as I said, ends up hesitating to take any action at all. And finally, Rufus Bratton prevails upon him, and he says, you have to warn Pearl Harbor. And Marshall finally decides to do it, and as I said, he attempted at first. He refused to use the scrambler phone, which would have put him in immediate contact with our commanders. He sent out claimed that the it was called WAR, I forget exactly what the acronym stand for, but it was that the radiogram system wouldn't work, although there's evidence that it worked just fine.
And of course he could use the naval, the secret naval codes and reach them, because the naval radios would go all the way around the world.
Yes, exactly. And he also, so he, as I say, he ended up using Western Union Telegram, sent from California to Hawaii, and finally delivered by a boy on a bicycle after the attack was over.
And I think this is really one of the most infuriating things, that they left the men there to die, and they send the message by Western Union. And I don't know how many of our listeners remember the movie that came out with Ben Affleck some couple of years ago on Pearl Harbor, and it depicts this boy, on the bicycle coming and giving the telegram. You know, and here's Admiral Kimmel standing there, and he's watching, and of course, our ships are sunk, our men are dead, our planes are down, and here's the little boy with a telegram. General, I've got a telegram for you, or Admiral, I've got a telegram for you from Washington, D.C. It says the attack is coming on Pearl Harbor. So they could not let Admiral Kimmel know, because he could have put his fleet to sea. They could have had the planes in the air instead of them all bunched up together on the field to make an ideal target. But the one thing they didn't want to do was discourage the Japanese from attack. Had the ships gone to sea, had the planes been in the air, had Pearl Harbor been on the alert.
Yes. I've had a lot of people tell me, I asked the question, well, look, we knew the Japanese were going to attack. What would Roosevelt have had to lose if he had notified our commanders in the field? Because Short would have been on guard, and Admiral Kimmel would have sortied the fleet, and but you would still have your casus belli. You would still have the Japanese attack would have been exposed, and that would be sufficient grounds for Roosevelt to ask for a declaration of war against Japan anyway. But it wouldn't have worked, and the reason why it wouldn't have worked is because the commander of the Japanese strike force, Admiral Nagumo, had been given strict orders to turn around and go back if his attack was detected. And then you would not have had your casus belli. In other words, they wouldn't have followed through with the attack on Hawaii if Nagumo knew that his preparations for the attack had been detected. That's the reason why Roosevelt could not warn Kimmel and Short and still have his war.
But they needed an incident to get us into the war.
And if he had notified Kimmel and Short, and if they had taken the appropriate actions, Nagumo would have found out about it, and he would have known that they had found out that he was planning a surprise attack, and he was in orders to call the attack off, and then you wouldn't have had the war.
But, of course, one of the most discouraging things is that they tried and tried to humiliate and court-martial. Well, they actually wouldn't court-martial either Admiral Kimmel or General Short. They had the hearings, but they refused steadfastly to court-martial them. And Admiral Kimmel and Short kept demanding a court-martial so the truth could come out, and all the things that the Roosevelt administration did to prevent a court-martial, to prevent the truth from coming out.
Admiral Kimmel. Right. His his sons took up his cause even after his death. And finally, as late as 1999, Congress did actually pass a resolution exonerating Kimmel and Short from any dereliction of duty. Of course, by then they were both dead. And as it happened, the President of the United States at that time, Bill Clinton, refused to sign the resolution.
And so, and basically because they still don't want the American people to know the truth, what really happened on the Day of Infamy. Mm-hmm. That's really so incredible that Bill Clinton, you know, 55 years later, almost, anyway, let's see, 50, I don't know how many years later, but somewhere in there, well over 50 years later, refused to sign the statement by Congress exonerating Admiral Kimmel and General Short. Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, the moral of the story is, I guess, don't trust your government. There's a difference between loyalty to your country and loyalty to your government.
And, of course, I believe that there are dark and sinister forces and secret societies working at the highest levels of our government, and we'll talk more about that when we get back. David, thank you so very much for being with us again. David was with us earlier this morning and again this afternoon, because I think we should never forget the lesson of the Day of Infamy. Bye-bye and God bless you.
Remember Pearl Harbor.
Amen.
Thank you.
Have you ever wondered what really happened at Waco? Have you ever wondered if maybe the government was not giving you the full story? Well, there is the most amazing video. It's called Waco, The Rules of Engagement, 2.5 gripping hours of the story of a government onslaught under a group of peaceable people. Now, their religion may be different than yours and mine, but they were still Christians, they still believed in the Bible, and they believed that the government would one day become their enemy and destroy them. Well, Waco, The Rules of Engagement is a video that everybody who loves freedom should see, because the ultimate conclusion is the government did not want them to come out. The government did everything they could to keep them from coming out, to antagonize them, loud music, lights all the time, to totally create a situation where they could not think clearly or would respond normally. Waco, The Rules of Engagement is currently unavailable at the regular sources. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR right now.
When was the last time you used Pure Soap? I mean real, hard-to-find, all-natural Pure Soap that contains no dyes, perfumes, deodorants, or antibacterials. Probably never, right? Hey folks, Michael Trudeau here, and I want to tell you about my friend Marty. He's the owner and founder of the Calben Soap Company. For the past 55 years, the Calben Soap Company has been making triple concentrated pure soaps exclusively for healthcare professionals and hospitals. Now for the first time, Calben Pure Soap is available factory direct to you and your family. Calben Pure Soap is made from all natural ingredients. It's earth-friendly and it's safe. Call the Calben Soap Company today toll-free at 1-800-340-7091. That's 1-800-340-7091. Save up to 85% off supermarket and retail store prices. Visit them on the web at calbenpuresoap.com or call for information at 1-800-340-7091. That web address again is calbenpuresoap.com. Try Pure Soap once and I guarantee you'll never use anything else.
You know, when I was growing up, my parents weren't worried about our education. We were taught the basics of math and English, science and history, the joy of art and music, and the need for sports. And our generation turned out leaders in every field. But as a parent today, I am concerned with my child's education. That's why I chose VHM Christian School. I know that at VHM, my children are getting a quality education with a biblical foundation. I'm not worried whether they'll be prepared. I know they are. VHM gives my children the tools to succeed and instills moral values. There are so many issues for me to be concerned about. I'm glad my children's education is not one of them. Won't you call VHM today? Your child is worth it. Call 475-4762. That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We have carry the book, of course, Infamy Revisited by David Wade. We carry Robert Stinnett's book because we think it's an important book. We have a 4-tape set on Pearl Harbor with interviews with Robert Stinnett. with John Tolan and then with Admiral Thomas Moore, who was actually at the time was a naval aviator at Pearl Harbor, who went on to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and certainly the most widely esteemed officer in the United States prior to his death. So that's the four tape set on Pearl Harbor. The book, Day of Deceit, Infamy Revisited, the four tapes out on Pearl Harbor, all available by calling 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV. War. And if you'd like a free copy of that letter that Ambassador Dodd sent to Colonel House, which I found in Colonel House's papers, we'll be glad to send that to you free of charge if you just give us a call and ask for it. If you get some of the other items, or we'll even send it to you if you don't get some of the other items. 1-800-544-8927. How do you begin to put this into a pattern? How do you really understand it? Well, it really are secret societies. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a 32nd degree Mason, and of course he was interlocked with all the other millions of Masons in America who worship a different god, and until you understand that, you can't understand anything going on and why these people would keep the secrets that plunged us into the Second World War. And because if you actually, of course, are a Mason, and you have sworn your oaths of allegiance, why you've promised to allow yourself to be killed, or your tongue cut out, or your chest cut open, or your abdomen cut open and killed under all sorts of excruciating terms, if you ever reveal any of the secrets or betray anything, or betray another Mason. And so this is why if you are a Mason, you don't have to worry about other Masons exposing you or revealing your secrets. So we have written a book called The Brotherhood of Darkness, and we have a video by the same name. It's called Brotherhood of Darkness. It goes into not simply Masonry, but a myriad of secret societies that exist in America today. The Rosicrucians, the Theosophists, the Council on Foreign Relations. Communism works as a secret society. And of course, we would hope that you'd want to sometime watch that video, but we have an opportunity to put that onto a DVD, which many people would watch now, and to raise the funds to actually put that onto DVD, we're making an amazing offer. If you will come up with $99, you'll get 25 DVDs as soon as we get them made. We're going to have them professionally done, and so we can make this offer. And we only need have three or four more people. We'll have enough funds to go ahead and put the order in. And you'll get, as soon as we have them in hand, the 25 DVDs of the Brotherhood of Darkness, which you can lend out to people and help them understand what's really going on. You can't understand anything today. You can't understand Iraq. It really doesn't make sense. You can't understand Vietnam. The mightiest nation in the world, the United States, couldn't defeat a nation, a little tiny nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and a 10-year war, and we lost the war. We never went over to win. If you really want to understand the wars, you need to get our tape, Iraq, the Untold Story, and of course the syllabus goes with it because it covers all of the wars of the last century, and maybe someday we'll have that on DVD, but right now we want to put the Brotherhood of Darkness onto DVD. And we hope that many of you will give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you're interested, hopefully by today or tomorrow at the latest, we will have sufficient backing to make the DVD up. And then, of course, we hope that you'll go to our website, pull down our newsletters. If you'd like to understand how all of the secret societies fit together and are working to impoverish the American people and destroy our economy, you need to get our three pamphlet set. They're called The Occult Hierarchy, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3. That's The Occult Hierarchy. They're only $3.95 each, or all three of them for $9.95. And they'll give you insight into the secret societies and the master plan, which is laid out in something called the Earth Charter. And we'll send you that free of charge if you'd like. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection until tomorrow at the same time. May the Lord be with you.